Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Hello, and welcome to Season 4, Episode 35 of Undermine, brought to you by Osiris Media. I'm Tom Marshall, your host, as we revisit and relive Phish's famous Fall 97 tour. We're diving into each show of that tour on its 25th anniversary. And if you're just joining us, we began this season with 25 shows from the 90s that got us to this point. And here we are in the present past tense. It's November 28th, 25 years later. As always, I'm joined by a co-host, one of two. Guess who? If you're watching on YouTube, you already know, as the ladies will take note of his good looks, but shh, don't ruin it for our Spotify listeners. Okay, spoiler alert, it's Benji Eisen. Hi, Benji.
Hi, Tom. Before we get started, you know, I just realized this is my big opportunity where I get to quote a lyric back to you, and that is happy, happy, oh, my friend. You just celebrated a birthday.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, I've been hearing versions of that. Some people say happy number line, which is kind of cool. It's become the Phish way of saying happy birthday. So thank you. Yes, November 12th was my birthday, and thank you very much.
You were eight and I wasn't born. But let's get right into the show. I'll just qualify, you know, unlike some of our earlier guests this season, on this night, I was there in the building, and I enjoyed myself. You know, the night that we're talking about, and it's also the subject of today's episode, November 28th, 1997. So the venue is the Worcester Centrum. The band, of course, is Phish. And the advertisement claimed that their hands were faster than guns. So now it's the 10th show of the Fall 97 tour. And notably, it's the band's first time playing the Centrum, not on a New Year's Eve run. So, you know, very briefly, their first Centrum show was New Year's Eve 93, my first show as well. Then they returned for two shows leading up to New Year's Eve 95 on the four-show run. And now it's 2 years after that. And the band starts a very short-lived, but immediately embraced, Thanksgiving weekend tradition, Three Nights in Worcester. I wish that tradition continued. Talking of traditions, this is traditionally part of the podcast where I traditionally inform our friends out there listening that, hey, if you're enjoying ourselves, then please help us to continue to entertain you by supporting the show via our new Osiris premium offering. It's for less than the price of a drink. You'll get bonus episodes of this show as well as HF Pod, access to the entire Under the Scales catalog, ad-free episodes, meet and greets, AMAs, and even a chance to appear as a guest on one of our shows. After all, how the hell do you think I got here? Check out osirispod.com/premium or click on the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Benji, for saying that. I agree with everything Benji just said.
You know, Tom, that's actually the thing that I said at the Thanksgiving table this year when we all said what we're thankful for. I'm thankful that Tommy G agrees with me. Now pass the cranberry sauce. One more thing that I think we're also, at least I'm thankful for, and that's that, you know, we all have a lot of memories of these fall 97 shows. Whether we can remember them is another question, but, you know, we've been sharing our stories and we want to hear yours. So to that end, I would encourage any of you who went to any of these fall 97 shows to make a 1 minute video clip, telling your tale, weighing your way, dropping your 2 cents. Post them on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, tag Osiris Pod, and we will choose a contributor at random who will win a handwritten copy of the Lyrics to Ghost from our friend Tom Marshall. You know, guys, he even promises to make it legible.
I do.
Honestly, Tom, you know, truthfully, this is just, I think that's so cool. I'm already jealous of the winner. In fact, let's change the subject. Tati, tell us about our guest today.
All right, I'm going to bring him in early. And today's guest is David Goldstein, who co-hosted a popular Osiris podcast called Beyond the Pond with our fellow Undermine executive producer, Brian Brinkman. On that podcast, Brian and David talked about bands other than Phish who are somehow linked via influence or inspiration. Today, we're going to set up guardrails, though, so he stays in one lane and only talks about one band.
King Gizzard.
I will happily talk to you about King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard at another date.
Yes, another date.
I'm on board. Anyway.
This is a Phish. Yes, I bet we figured you'd be. And welcome to our Phish podcast, David Goldstein. Since I didn't give Benji his proper credentials in the intro, you know, New York Times bestselling author and whatever else I'm supposed to say about him. Sorry, Benji. Let's check on yours, David. Let's do a little background check. When did you start seeing Phish and anything else you might want to say about you that can help our listeners?
Okay. My first Phish show was June 28th, 1995 at Jones Beach, Long Island, followed by the next night, June 29th. See, I was 15 years old. So my birthday is in September. So I was 15 at the time and had been hip to Phish and the Dead via Jewish youth groups, which is many people's first intro to Phish and
Jewish,
the Dead.
Jewish youth groups. You found out about them in camp. Is that right?
Camp can be an outcropping of that. This wasn't so much camp as okay. It was just stuff in the state of Connecticut where 15-year-old Jewish kids tend to find out about Phish, Dead, and marijuana at the same time under the guise of hanging out with other Jews. So the parents are like, it's great. Please do that.
And they're genius. Right. They're right.
Genius marketing scheme.
Exactly. So, yeah, summer 95, 35-minute tweezer. That was my first this experience.
I wish I had Jewish parents.
You know, Dave, fall 97 was before the age of real-time streams, pocket downloads, and live Phish, of course. So up until this point in the tour, most of the guests that we've talked to who attended the previous shows didn't really have a chance to hear fall 97 Phish until the night in question. But now we're 10 shows deep. The Denver run already happened, Hampton already happened, and even though there weren't instant downloads, Phish Internet was all ablaze with the written word, as, you know, dorks like me would gush online about the shows that we caught. So, you know, we were talking about what's it all mean? Have they turned into this hippie rave band? Why is everyone calling it Cal Funk? Were you following along at home? And was this night in Worcester your first chance to see or even hear anything from this tour?
It was not, because, sorry about that. No, actually, at this point, I was a freshman in college in fall 1997. I was at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, where I know Mr. Marshall is very familiar with as well. And I think at this point, I was new enough tapers and was kind of hooked into the tape trading enough that I was generally able to get a tape about 10 days after the show transpired. So I was very familiar with Europe 97, certainly summer 97. I think probably I had heard Hampton before going to the shows. Like, I have a memory of myself listening to the Hampton AC/DC bag, just like transfixed and staring at my stereo and not knowing what the hell was going on. So that may have been after the shows. I can't quite recall. Just one of those freshman dorm room, what does it all mean type things. But I think I had some kind of idea at this point that there was going to be Cal Funk involved, just based upon having gone to the Great Went, having heard the summer 1997 shows, especially God the Ghost from, I think, July 23rd, 97 from Atlanta, is fucking porno Cal Funk action to the max. So, yeah, I had some idea. I wasn't going in totally blind.
This venue, so it holds a spot in my heart ever since they started playing it for that that show, I guess, was that 93? And the way I remember it, you know, it's there's a lot of venues that look like this from the inside, a fairly typical mid-size hockey arena. But it was built in the 80s, which means it actually wasn't all that old when we were there for this weekend 25 years ago. To you, David, was this or is this a good place to see Phish?
I've often wondered if Worcester is actually a good place to see Phish, or good just because I've seen Phish there, I want to say like 10 times. And it holds a lot of, you know, I mean, to me, the ultimate Phish is minor league hockey arena in Rust Belt, New England in the fall. And This show checks all those boxes. I think it's a good, I don't know. I'm guessing they don't play there anymore, maybe because it's not up to the modern standards of some other arenas. I used to think it was because it wasn't Live Nation, but it actually is a Live Nation venue. But I guess they haven't played there since 2013. So there must be some reason, but I enjoyed seeing Phish here. I'm from New England. I'm from Connecticut. It wasn't that far from home. The lot scene, despite having lots of broken bottles in the alley behind the venue, was always pretty lively. I think the next night I had the worst burrito I've ever had in my life. It tasted like gasoline. But if we can get past that, yeah, I think this is a classic venue to see Phish, put it that way.
No question.
I agree. I think we all have, you know, such fond memories of this, you know, little hockey arena in a town that it's not the obvious, you know, like when you say Worcester, it doesn't sparkle like Boston or Philadelphia or New York, but there's definitely something to it. You know, because I also, when Phish announces shows at Worcester, I mean, I'm there.
I'll say, just hold a soft spot for me, because my first Rush show in 1994 is at Worcester Centrum.
Right. So. That's awesome. Awesome.
Dave, that's amazing, because my first show, New Year's Eve 93, in this room, at the end of it, leaving, I asked my friend, you know, my life was forever changed. And my friends that I went with, I asked them what they thought of it after meeting up outside afterwards. And my friend said, that was really good, but I can't wait till Rush comes here.
One of the best nights of my life, let me tell you.
There you go. So, you know, the band certainly enjoyed their time at the venue, and it shows itself repeatedly through all their appearances there, definitely throughout this weekend. But here we are. It's a Friday night. Everyone made a mad dash to the middle of Massachusetts from their Thanksgiving dinners the night before. The tryptophan is wearing off. The band seems to come out by making some type of statement, opening the whole run, the three nights there in Worcester with the curtain. It's kind of like an intention setter. Or, you know, it's a change of scene from the holiday dinner. Here we are, curtain goes up, let's go. So then in the two spot, Dave, what happens?
I'll just first say that was pretty much my experience. I saw the Hartford show, that the the Wednesday, and then we had chicken turkey dinner at my grandparents in Long Island on that Thursday, and Friday off to Worcester. So yeah, like you said, they start with the first curtain and 57 shows, and then You Enjoy Myself, Curtain Yim, 1997. Not much not to like, not much not to dislike, I should say. And yeah, that You Enjoy Myself, if you want an example of 1997 effortless laid-back funk, much like the Ghost in the second set, which we're going to get to. I mean, this Yim is such a flex. This is just laid-back, effortless, the funk, the guitar is playing itself. It's got the stop-start jamming, and instead of doing a vocal jam, it turns into I Didn't Know. Like, there's the essence of the vocal jam, and instead of they just kind of go right into the I Didn't Know. But just in, like, revisiting this Yim for this podcast, the word that comes to mind is just effortlessness. They wanted to play the funk. It's like they've been doing it their whole lives, despite the fact that they really didn't get into the cow funk until March 97, which you wouldn't know that.
It's a great Yim, and like you said, curtain to open into Yim. It's a wonderful moment. It's one of my favorites so far. I'm going back and listening to some of these shows. I believe I may have been at this show, and I'm sorry I don't know, but I know I went to a couple of these Worcester shows. So I'm bad at keeping. I've never like took notes, and you know, also mental notes I don't take very well either. But
you were
I
at
feel,
the next night. My friend met you backstage.
I was definitely at the next night. I was wondering if I was at this one, but anyway, then the first Vacuum solo of the tour with I Didn't Know, like you mentioned, then May's Farmhouse, which was brand new, and then another brand new tune, Black Eyed Katie, and that one, some have said it's kind of the signature song of the tour. Do you agree with that, and what were your initial impressions from this particular version?
Yeah, the signature song from the tour, in the sense that it kind of announced, like, we are into the cow funk. We're going to play the cow funk. You're going to get an instrumental that's nothing but cow funk that allows us to kind of like dabble in that. And it's got a cool name, Black Eyed Katie. And on the soundboard of Worcester, in between songs, you can hear Paige Trey go, Black Eyed Katie? And it happens. But just with regards to that farmhouse, I just wanted to mention, I think that might have been the second or third time they played it in its original key of D. They dropped it down to C. Because when Trey tries to sing it in D, he kind of sounds like a bar mitzvah boy who hasn't gone through puberty yet. So smart putting that in C major. But yeah, the Black Eyed Katie, you know, they're all sound pretty similar from night to night. But yeah, it's an excellent piece of instrumental funk. I'll never say no to more fish instrumentals. I loved it in 99 when they were playing Back of the Chicken Shack. So it's cool.
You know, eventually, Tom, you and your lyricist, Scott Herman, would add lines like all throughout I Gaze and Glimpse You, and then Black Eyed Katie would transform into what is now known as the MoMA dance. The MoMA dance, the moment ends. It's obviously a fun play on words. You know, the MoMA dance, moment ends. MoMA dance, the moment ends. Tom, can you solve this? I don't know if it's a mystery, but can you just solve this for us once and for all? Was there, it was either just a playful and purposeful miss here of the lyric, or is there something else there too, like along the lines of an inside joke or a secret smile? Before you answer, I just looked at the clock and we have to take a quick commercial break. So at least we know. Everyone will stay tuned for that cliffhanger. We'll be right back with Tom's answer and with more from David Goldstein as we discuss Worcester 11-28-97.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. Got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
And we are back with our guest, David Goldstein. And before the break, Benji asked me about the song title, The MoMA Dance. And if it's just a play on words, the moment ends, the MoMA Dance. And the survey says, of course it is. We all know that. But during the break, something else came to me. And it was kind of how at some point I was half expecting, like the meat stick, that Fish would create a MoMA Dance dance. And I think we could all thank Iculus that that never happened. David, I don't know how you feel about MoMA Dance dances or even meat stick dances, but let's talk. A few episodes back, one of our guests brought up the idea of Black Eyed Katie as a bust out. If given the, you know, currently, if given the chance between that and a jammed out MoMA, which would you choose?
I would pick the Black Eyed Katie just from the novelty aspect of it. I mean, it would be need to see who could pick it out as opposed to say, oh, Black Eyed Katie versus MoMA Dance. I like the MoMA Dance. I mean, I like jammed out versions. Sometimes I think it's a bit of a first song, first set, second song, first set crutch. Sometimes I kind of use it as a chance to go get a beer while funking outside. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I think a Black Eyed Katie bust out would be neat, although I think also kind of that ship has sailed. There's other songs I would prefer they bust out before that.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
I mean, I always love a jammed out MoMA, but Black Eyed Katie, there's the novelty of it, right? Because they haven't done it for so long.
What was the recent jammed out MoMA? Was it like Atlantic City?
Atlantic City was a jammed out MoMA, yeah.
Yes, that was fucking awesome.
It was great. There was a few in 4.0 actually that I've really, really stretched out and were just phenomenal. But I have a soft spot for the song itself. I just love it. But let's actually move forward into the five song second set. You know, it's interesting. I say five song second set. I know that everyone wants the four song second set, but five, if you look at timings, five just kind of means it went longer, right? So do we skip right to the ghost?
No.
Good. Tell me what would be missing out if we did.
You'd be missing out on hearing Fish in Fall 1997 is what you're missing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything. Fall 97, we've got a band that was pushing every possible right button. Like, how can you be this good at like your job? So
everything, yeah.
When you see, right, Timberhoe, excellent, lively, jammed out version. Limb by Limb, it doesn't ever change keys. It's still a pretty new song at that time, but it's a very strong, interesting little conversion. I mean, Slave to the Traffic Light, third song in set two. I mean, none of it appears all that exciting on paper, but these are excellent versions by a band at the top of their game. So definitely.
Limb by Limb too had peeps that they don't really do with it anymore. And it had this kind of like up and down, you know? Yeah. Journey. It was a journey.
Yep, exactly. And then we do, of course, though, have to talk about that ghost. Dave, how do you remember it?
Well, I will say it's probably the single Ghost I listened to more than any other Ghost in my Fish career.
Really?
Oh.
It might be my single favorite version of the song, because it's just, we go back to the word effortlessness. And if you like slap bass, if you want to hear Mike Gordon in your chest, all the work that the people for A Louder Mike did, this is, he's not playing the bass so much as he has an instrument that sounds like it's full of like elastic bands, just like popping, just popping off, yeah. Almost like Les Claypool in the sense of the popping dexterity. Mm. But with this Ghost, it's basically the entire bag of Cow Funk tricks. It's got the Trey breakdown jamming. It's got the stop start jamming. It has a motif at the end where Trey's playing quietly. It's like a cat and mouse game. He's stringing you along. He brings it up. This is like superhero shit. Like, I can't imagine any one point on a Ghost in the band is this incredibly locked in. Rages and the Johnny Be Good, it's just like a logical progression. The only way to end the 65-minute set is with Johnny Be Fucking Good after that Ghost.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I also love the Atlanta Ghost that you brought up earlier. As one of my favorites, you know, and I know that when we mentioned Black Eyed Katie just a few minutes ago, we said how, you know, a lot of people have viewed it as kind of the signature tune of the tour, but Ghost was kind of the song of the year. You know,
starting with the first show in U.S. Shores at
Virginia
July
Beach.
July 21st, Virginia Beach opened that show with Ghost, a really extended version with a statement of purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, on Twitter, we can work and the guys at Woodplast in collaboration with our guy, Brian Brinkman.
Good guy, Brian Brinkman.
Yes. So they did a Ghost bracket recently where they ranked all the top Ghosts by taking votes on a playoff style, you know, matches. Not surprisingly, this one did very well, but ultimately lost to 11-17-97, which was Denver, literally just two versions prior to this.
Right.
And then you have the Hamptons Ghost in between. You know, you said just a few moments ago that this Ghost might be your favorite Ghost of all time. What other Ghosts do you think made that podium for you?
I love Atlanta 97. July 23rd, that just gets to a peak where limbs flailing and flying. More recently, this one's kind of unsung, I think. October 23rd, 2018 from Nashville, the first night of a two-night run at Nashville. That has some Trey Gordon interplay where it sounds like they're sword fighting. That's just like some incredible, incredible peaks. With regard to the November 17, 97 version from Denver, to me, that one has a sense of discovery. Like the band is realizing their toolbox. They're looking at it. They can't believe what they had. They're like, my God, we can do this and this. The sky is the limit. It's like they're opening the fucking treasure chest and it's shining in their face. Whereas 11 days later in Worcester, they've mastered the tools. So this is...
I think that just sets the intention for the rest of the tour, 11-17, yeah.
Whereas, yeah, November 28th, it's just... I mean, I'll give you an analogy I've been thinking of. When I think of Fish in the fall of 1997, there's a restaurant in Chicago me and my wife like go into a lot, not a lot, I've been three times, called Alinea. It's the Great Grand Ackett's. It's a huge price fixed meal. It's expensive and everything is so delicious, but it's so fun that as you're eating the meal, you're like laughing to yourself the entire time. It's like you're eating and you're laughing. You're saying, how can anybody be this good at their job? This is incredible. And that's Phish, November of 1997. You're rocking out, but you're laughing, saying, how can this be this good? How can they be this dialed in? And this goes to me is an excellent example of that because it practically sounds composed.
You know, it's such a good description, Dave. It's like you look around at the fans. Everyone was like this family, and everyone was smiling, and the band was smiling. It was like, it was incredible. I remember the happiness kind of the most, you know, of that time and just how great the music was. So you're so right. I got to check out that restaurant too. That sounds amazing. And I'm drooling now, but, Phish finishes the night, as you said, with Johnny B. Goode, which Trey loved playing, right? It's like, well, Hendrix's version, you know, that's what he's playing. And then, a My Soul encore, and you leave, but you came back both the next two nights.
And no, I didn't come back Sunday.
Oh, okay. Okay. You came back in two nights. At the end of the weekend, where did this particular show stand in the context of the run for you and in the context of Fall 97 at large?
It was my favorite of the three. Mm. The next night, I actually was on the rail for that, that night. We scored mail order tickets really well. So for the 29th.
Nice.
The Runaway Gym, it's an hour long. It's impressive. Sometimes I think it gets a bit dull, but that's one man's opinion. I was kind of struggling to stay awake at points. That was actually the night when your buddy Big Phil kind of kicked us out of our seats up front.
Is there a reason? Were you guys misbehaving?
No, I think I've told you this story before. For the listeners, me and my buddies are up front and then at set break. And then we get back and we see this very large man kind of sitting in our rail seats at set break. And I'm thinking, who the hell is this guy? But my friend Kevin spoke to him and became friendly with him. And so he gave Kevin the backstage pass to go see you, Tom, and the band, and he'd give me anything. So that was Big Phil. But I forgive you. It's okay.
That was the Braves.
So you got kicked out of your seat by a very friendly person.
Yeah, exactly. Not so much kicked out. We wouldn't get kicked out. It just became more cramped.
But also a person that you wouldn't want to hassle or tussle with in any way.
Exactly. You tell me he's like very nice and brings candy and like pretzels backstage.
And so I deserve your front row seats. Yeah, exactly. Right.
The third night of the run, I probably listened to the least. It's got that incredibly heavy, cool Wolfman's Brother and the Funky Bitch in the first set. It's got the Buddy Miles encore. But it's a very good show by any objective standard. I just haven't listened to it as much.
Got it. I think that's going to do it for us today. We're going to go into those shows, as you know, 25 years after they actually happen. And so thank you so much, David Goldstein, for joining us. And thanks to my co-host, Benji Eisen, for asking all the hard questions. RJB, you too, and the entire Osiris team, especially Eric Limarenko and Matt Dwyer, for making all this work from behind the scenes. And let me give a quick shout out to our friends over at Cash or Trade. Hi, Brando, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check out all the tickets at cashortrade.org. Coming up next, like I said, two more nights at the Worcester Centrum. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. And until then, feel free to take the Worcester Gym out for a spin and blaze the most on. Thank you, Benji. Thank you, David.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Osiris.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that, you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.